Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is Jamie Floyd in for Brian Lehrer on WNYC. There is no document, be it the Constitution or the 12 Traditions of Alcoholics Anonymous, which can survive major shifts in our social dynamics entirely intact. Alcoholics Anonymous is now in its 76th year and is facing those challenges to the concept of anonymity. While some in recovery are grateful for that second word, others are seeking a more delicate balance in an age of Facebook openness and even oversharing and more evolved perceptions of alcoholism than there were 75 years ago. Books about sobriety and recovery are almost as common as mainstream references to addiction and indeed to AA. In a much more public world, the organization has been pushing back just as people declare their sobriety more openly. Joining me now to talk about his piece, Challenging the Second A in AA, in last weekend's New York Times, is contributing writer David Coleman. Welcome to WNYC, David.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
We're going to have our listeners participate in this segment. If you have anyone that you love who is a part of AA, or if you yourself have been part of AA, or in the support group Al-Anon, give us a call and share your take on anonymity. How are you managing the delicate balance of keeping your recovery under wraps? Or are you proud and open about your sobriety? We want to hear from you. 212-433-WNYC. That's 212-433-9692. Of course, if you don't want to give your name, that's fine. You can use a pseudonym. You can be anonymous here, or you can give your name proudly and openly. 212-433-WNYC. 212-433-9692. So, David, the lead of your piece was very compelling. You just came right out and said it. I'm David Coleman, and I'm an alcoholic. And you say that that's the first time in 15 years that you've written or said those words so publicly. So how do you feel now that you've done that in the New York Times of all places?
Well, I feel as ambivalent now as I did, you know, doing it. I can't say that I did it with wholeheartedly. I did it to sort of make a point that this is a real shift that we're seeing, and I was trying to draw attention to it and kind of make a point that, saying, hi, my name is David and I'm an alcoholic, that makes a certain kind of point about anonymity. Making the opposite point this way makes a different one.
And so let's talk a little bit about that history of AA and why the anonymity and where that came from. Why was that important to Bill Wilson, one of the founders of the organization 75 years ago?
Well, it's actually a complicated thing, and it's confusing to a lot of people, and it has two aspects specifically that are enumerated in AA's 12 traditions, and one of them, the 11th tradition, is the one that people are most kind of familiar with in the program, too, which is the one where we say, you know, we need to preserve anonymity on the level of press, radio, and films. And that's the one that, you know, most people think of when you talk about Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, that, you know, you don't say your last name, you don't, you sort of don't talk about your recovery that openly or publicly, things like that. And the reason was, you know, in 75 years ago, the idea that alcoholism was even a medical condition was alien to a lot of people. And it was still seen as a moral weakness, and which is true to a lesser degree, but still present today. And so people wanted to preserve, you know, to protect themselves against any kind of stigma. And so, you know, you went there. You didn't say who you saw there. It was on the QT. It was, you know, hush hush. And I think that that was a wonderful thing. I mean, I think that that is certainly what enabled AA to grow.
And write about how the perceptions of alcoholism have changed. You write about it very eloquently.
Thank you.
That, you know, 75 years ago, there hadn't been much research on alcoholism. And it wasn't just seen as a weakness, but as a disgrace.
Yeah.
Do you think that was true of other addictions, too?
I don't think that You know, even insofar that alcoholism was a disgrace, I think that people were cognizant of it. I don't think that people really even knew about other things because, and if they did know about things like heroin addiction. Mm-hmm. I'm just trying to think, you know, I don't really know what else was so much around in the 1930s that mm-hmm. people would have been, but at any rate, I certainly don't think that people thought of sex addiction then. I don't think that was a
We just didn't think in terms of addiction the way we do now. Let's take a call from David. He's on the Upper East Side. David, you're on with David Coleman, who wrote last week's piece in the New York Times. Please go ahead. Are you with us, David?
Well, I am, but not maybe the other David.
All right, we're going to try and get David, our caller, online. And David Coleman, let me ask you to explain the difference between the 11th principle and the 12th. I guess they're called traditions.
Yeah.
The 11th tradition and the 12th tradition in AA, and why that's significant for this conversation.
Well, I think that the thing is that you have this 11th tradition that's a very much of a practical concern, addressing the possibility of stigmatization and of people finding out inadvertently, you know her, she's an AA. It's like, well, you know, like people should, you know, people want to be able to protect that information. You know, and I think that this sort of goes to illustrate the similarities people were talking about in the struggle with gay rights. And, you know, we're talking about a something that distinguishes you. It's so it sort of makes you in some degree a minority, but it's an invisible, you know, it's an invisible trait. And so people wanted, I think, for a long time to choose to keep that to themselves. That is that, I guess. And the 12th tradition is something, and, you know, they blur together to a certain extent, but the 12th tradition really addresses the idea of anonymity being a spiritual principle, which mm-hmm. is, I think, a little hard to grasp just from the language of it. But what it's really talking about is selflessness and, you know, namelessness and selflessness being sort of linked. And it's about kind of cultivating this aspect of humility where you go in, you know, as an addict, you're sort of fueled by want. You know, you just, it's a certain kind of higher level of, and a higher urgency of want or and or need than probably most people have is the only way I could probably describe it.
Yeah.
And so going in there and saying, you know, I'm going to put down this burden of want and self, you know, and sort of trying to get away from my own, trying to assuage my own self-centered, you know, self-directed needs and say, like, okay, I'm going to put this down. I'm going to ask somebody else.
Yeah.
Hey, what can I do for you? Hey, can I help make coffee? Hey, you know, let me lend a hand.
So
the
self becomes far less important or less central to one's existence. Let's take some of these calls. I do think we now have David on the Upper East Side. David, you're on with David Coleman, WMYC. Please go ahead.
Yeah, I'm listening to this. I'm a substance abuse counselor, and my work is primarily in the opiate addiction area. It doesn't matter. There's an awful lot of verbiage that I just heard, which obscures the core essence of anonymity, which is that, let's say that I'm a person in recovery. I can identify myself as a person in recovery. You can't identify me as a person in recovery if you subscribe to that fellowship. If you're not in the fellowship, you're not aware of the principles and you're not going to pay much attention to them. But what you hear here, what you see here, leave it here, is the core of the safety net that all the 12-step programs provide to their members. The idea, for example, there's a meeting. Somebody shares something in that meeting. Someone else normally comes to that meeting but wasn't there that night. A person who was there doesn't even tell the person who wasn't there what somebody said. Because for all they know, the person who was speaking said what they said, knowing that third person wasn't there. It's the person in recovery's decision
yes.
as to whether they're vulnerable.
Yes, your point is well taken, David, on the Upper East Side as a substance abuse counselor, that it is for the individual in recovery to determine whether or not to remain anonymous. Let's take a call from Ed in Baltimore, New Jersey. Ed, you're on WNYC.
Hello.
Hello. Please go ahead.
Yeah. So I'm a sober alcoholic from Belmar. I've been sober this month to be 22 years.
Congratulations.
And thank you. And as I understand, and I only use my first name because that's the way the tradition asks us to only identify ourselves with our first names, even in meetings.
Did you go through Alcoholics Anonymous, Ed?
Yes.
The 12-step program.
Yes. And no, you know, I just came in off the street, you know, no rehab, anything like that. And AA has served me very well. The way I understand it and the way the tradition is written, it's anonymity at the level of press, radio, and film. And the way I have come to understand it is that it's not only to protect the individual and to give the individual a choice as to how anonymous they want to be, but also to protect the organization itself. And I always cringe whenever I see celebrities outing themselves as, you know, they went to rehab and now they're in AA. And because what happens is if that person drinks again or if that person winds up in jail or in the newspaper again drunk or on drugs, it makes the organization look bad, like AA doesn't work. Oh, look, there's, you know, you can think of any number of examples. I don't want to use their names, but, you know, there's a lot of examples in the tabloids of people who've been in and out of rehabs and have been to AA and, you know, drink again. And it makes the organization look bad, like AA doesn't work.
Very good point, Ed, and I'm going to turn back to David Coleman on that. Thank you very much for your call and your candor, Ed. David, how about that point? This is a very, very good point, that the anonymity is not only for the recovering addict, but also for the organization itself.
It's an interesting point, and it's a point you will hear over and over and over again to defend the principle of anonymity and the level of press, radio, and film. And actually, where it sprang from was in the 50s and 40s, you know, when AA was new, there was a potential for people to get sort of excited about this and actually try and say, hey, well, you know, I'm an AA person, you know, can I take out an ad, you know, in some paper that actually kind of communicates that I'm like the, you know, dry cleaner in town that's like, that's sober. And that's like almost a badge of honor. And that people were started to get very concerned that AA, you know, it was like these people were thinking that it could almost be like, you know, a Rotary Club.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to remember that, you know, the temperance movement was, you know, was not long before this, and that, you know, these kinds of societies were used in business circles as a kind of, you know, like that triple A seal of approval that you see on motels sometimes. And so they wanted, and very honorably, I think, wanted to guard against AA being used as some kind of draw. They wanted, and so that was one thing that, that was how it kind of came about in this way, that they didn't want it linked to people. They didn't want it abused in that way. But to answer specifically this fellow's assertion, you know, this is something you hear constantly, but it doesn't really make too much sense, to be perfectly honest, because, you know, we do see celebrities come out of rehab all the time and they slip. And you know what? It doesn't necessarily, I mean, it reflects badly on recovery. Whether they say they're in AA or not.
On the organization AA,
yeah,
but on recovery in general. How has social networking changed AA? You write about Facebook and of course, there's Twitter and Tumblr and all of these very public sites. And some members of AA have actually posted photographs of meetings,
yes,
on Facebook. How does AA respond, and how do other members respond?
Well, I mean, I think that's all up to, you know, I mean, AA, you know, used to respond to these big breaches with, you know, I think that they would have like a member write a letter to somebody. But that was back when. I mean, now, you know, AA doesn't really respond. I mean, AA is a very, you know, they're a very small organization. They're not an organization that enforces things. I mean, it is extremely loose. And, you know, in spite of people calling this a rule of AA, in AA there are no rules. Everything is a suggestion. And if I could just circle back briefly on something that Ed was saying, I mean, it certainly does not do the concept of recovery any good to see celebrities relapsing constantly. And so what is interesting here is that, I mean, as somebody with 15 years of recovery, what I think is part of the point is that you so seldom hear from people who have a long time in recovery, who have long-term sobriety standing up and saying this because they're trying to observe this principle. So, but as a result, the public has a very skewed view of recovered addicts being people who relapse constantly.
Which is why we valued your piece so much, and I am just about out of time, but David,
okay,
I do want to refer people back to your piece of last week, Challenging the Second A in AA, last weekend's New York Times, by contributing writer David Coleman. My guest has been David Coleman, and he wrote about the delicate balance of anonymity in Alcoholics Anonymous. Thank you very much, David. I'm Jamie Floyd, in for Brian Lehrer, and coming up next, we will talk all about prison abuse, and also the covert war in Iran. We'll be right back.